Coming to you live from the Tomb of Horrors, my name is Tom, and with me as always is the skeletal remnant of a demigod archlich, and this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode Grape W.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I'm Tom.
And today we're going to be talking about games we like, games we hate, games we're generally ambivalent toward, and why.
True. We are going to talk about that. So in the last edition of our delightful podcast, you hinted at a divergence in our game preferences when we were talking about Eclipse, which, for those of you that don't know, is a large, epic scale, you know, multiple hour long game of space empire conquest warfare, which has a lot of components, a lot of parts, a lot of moving pieces, a lot of fiddly bits, a lot of math and numbers. It's the sort of thing that just makes the 12-year-old version of me super excited. And I never actually grew up, so...
That is true.
Yeah. Yeah. But Johannes hates it with a passion. And one of my favorite things that has ever happened in life was this time we were having a game day, and my friend Devin... busts out, what's the game?
Terra Mystica.
No, not Terra Mystica. Before that, the other one. Cosmic Encounter.
Cosmic Encounter.
He breaks up Cosmic Encounter and he says, you guys are going to love Cosmic Encounter. And he starts to set out the pieces and whatnot. And he's breaking out, you know, little cardboard planets and decks of cards that are about as, you know, as tall as my hand is thick. And he's getting out little stacks of plastic spaceships and all this stuff. And I'm looking at Johannes as this is happening, and I'm actively seeing the life fade from his eyes.
Like, it's true.
He was dying on the spot. Flash forward to the next time we have game day, he's not only campaigning to play Cosmic Encounter, he's like, okay, we need to wrap up this first game that we're playing, I don't remember what it was, faster, so that we can play Cosmic Encounter instead. We need to get to Cosmic Encounter as quickly as possible.
Because Cosmic Encounter is great.
Cosmic Encounter is pretty solid. Like, I like it. I don't like it as much as you do, but I like it a lot. It's pretty good. So we thought it would be interesting, or at least interesting to us, to go over and talk a little about what we like about these different types of games. Why I like Eclipse and you hate it. Why you like
Cosmic Encounter.
And so on. And that might be of interest to a person.
Well, so I think Tom is putting a little bit on me in the "you're an idiot and I'm better than you" category with Eclipse, in the way of saying that the problem is the math and the components. I don't have a problem with those things outright. I know when we design games, I'm always for fewer components because I want it to be something that the average person can grasp. It's not a question of components, not even necessarily a question of math. Those things come up when we're designing because I want it to be accessible to people. But the problem I have with Eclipse, other than a few mechanical things that I briefly mentioned before, I don't particularly care for the combat mechanic. But what I really don't like about Eclipse, because I do like the upgrade mechanic, I like the exploring, I like the, you know, the science stuff. What I don't like is the everyone against everyone else game of Eclipse. There are games of Eclipse that we have played that I have pretty much enjoyed quite a bit, actually, where my fellow players and opponents have allowed me to just kind of be combat free and explore, you know, the galaxy around me and upgrade my ships in ways that aren't necessarily directly defensive or offensive combat wise. And the problem is, in those two or three games that we've played that way, I've handily defeated everyone. So they'll probably never allow me to do it again. But those are what I've enjoyed. And so my problem really comes in when everyone is against everyone else. And I don't even necessarily dislike competitive games, but there's a part of me that likes them too much, And when that part of me comes out, if I were to really apply that part of me to Eclipse, I'd make some people cry. They would have a bad day. I might not even win, but we would all be mad at each other for at least a week when it was over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to avoid those sorts of games because that's the kind of game that isn't fun, really, for anyone, except maybe the guy who wins, who's like, yeah, I won because I screwed all you over, or I won in spite of you being mm-hmm. a dick. That's not great, you know? That's not a ton of fun for everyone when you're playing board games together with your friends. And that's my real problem with Eclipse. And there are other games that are like that too. And I've mentioned before Risk as sort of the very basic form of this every man against every other man, incredibly competitive sort of strategy game. They're just really mm-hmm. not my thing.
Mm-hmm. I think Risk actually illustrates to some extent, at least from my peculiar perspective, kind of the point you're making there, because I actually don't really play Risk anymore if I can at all help it.
Mm-hmm.
After a particularly nasty game where another player did more or less what you're describing, that you are tempted to do in games of Eclipse, where he became a monster and he's not. It gets to the point where with these very competitive games where you're 2.5 hours in, you've invested a lot of energy into your stuff, and you're like, well, it doesn't look like I'm going to win strictly by the numbers, but if I can make the guy sitting across from me kind of feel sad and bad about himself as a person, or if I can psych him out a little bit, you know, that's going to give me an edge. And like once right. it escalates from I'm running the numbers and trying to make the best move I can with the information I have in front of me to I am trying to mess with who you are as a person and use my knowledge of your personality to manipulate your weaknesses, that's where, for me, it becomes not fun anymore.
Yeah. I this is something we ran into as kids. We played... Tom and I have only really been into board games for the past, 5 years, maybe?
Roughly, six? Ballpark.
And, before that, we played a lot of video games, and we were both into Dungeons & Dragons, and Tom was into some Warhammer and some other tabletops for a while. But board games as a thing are really relatively new to us, and... So when we would play a lot of StarCraft or Warcraft 2, we never played against one another. I can remember maybe one time when we tried to play against one another. And it was the same sort of idea. Like, I was like, I could do this, but one of us is going to end up really mad at the other one if we really draw this game out to its final, like, to its fullest extent. And so we didn't do that. And so it's not even necessarily the, just the, like, I'm going to be deliberately evil about this problem of things. It's like you put so much into this and you get so invested in it. And again, this is another thing we talked about in the first episode about like video games and video game addiction, or even just like getting that kind of far into the competitive video game world where you find yourself like, I've lost and now I'm angry at a person over it, rather than being like, oh, well, you know, you got me. You were better than me that time.
And I think that's a good distinction to make, too, because like with Warcraft and StarCraft and any board game, if you're doing a competitive one, you're dedicating a chunk of time to it. Like a solid game of Warcraft 2 back then was still going to be a half hour, 45 minutes. And we were children, so that's
right.
more or less your entire summer gone right there.
Yeah, nothing like Risk where a full game only takes like 3 or 4 minutes.
Right, exactly. Yeah, totally different animal. But, I can remember we used to play, you know, multiplayer like GoldenEye or Mario Kart against each other. And that, I mean, we would get, pillows were thrown, bricks were thrown. I still have the scar. And I think of it every morning.
It serves you right, you.
That blue shell was a legit move. And I think about it every morning when I put in my glass eye. But, you know, that's a different animal when you've got this kind of short, round-based event where... Mm-hmm. Yeah, you lost that round, but you can come back in the next one and do differently and do better, maybe. Versus you've spent your evening playing Eclipse or Risk or whatnot, and now your games are done. You have to go be an adult again or responsible for something, and it was just a bad experience.
Yeah.
That's a slightly different animal that way. You don't want that.
Yeah. So if you take a look at the games that we've played, both board games and video games recently, and with our group of friends too, we got really into board games, I think, in large part because of Arkham Horror. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
That's pretty reasonable.
That's kind of that was our gateway drug, which seems weird because when you look at Arkham Horror, it's one of the most like over-the-top, fiddly, too many components, not everything works, lots of errata to fix the rules they didn't write correctly or at all in the first draft kind of game. But It's totally cooperative, and everyone's working together against this great old one. And also the game, our mantra when we play Arkham is always nothing bad happened, and that's effectively the same thing as something good happened, right? Nothing was bad, so that's good. Everything on you know, in Arkham, something horrible happens, and mm-hmm. and you're like, all right, we have our turn planned out, and then the game, you know, you draw a Mythos card that's like, actually, you're all screwed forever, and you die. But it's cooperative, and when we play video games, we're playing things like Dungeon Defenders and
Gauntlet. Was pretty Gauntlet. Good for a while.
What was the Vaunt Ships one actually called? Jamestown. We just call it Vaunt Ships because we're a little dumb. We played Magicka. There's a second Magicka coming out.
Is there really?
Super excited about. And these are games that, like, if you play by yourself, they're not all that great, in my experience anyway. And if you play competitively, you can't, because that's not how those games work. But so we tend toward a lot of very cooperative games. And even when we venture into the competitive gaming world, we end up with things like Dominion, where for the most part, other than a curse card here or there or some other interaction cards, you end up with only really, like, your victory points are counted up at the end, but most of what you do during the game is pretty contained to your turn. And so you're not, no one's sitting there going like, oh, you jerk, you just did this thing to me. It's like, okay, who's going to have the most points at the end? We don't get into the really, really competitive games all that often. Mm-hmm. So things like Eclipse and Terra Mystica, which you play, but I never did, really kind of stand out.
Well, and two, it that kind of ties into what you liked about Cosmic Encounter too, which is that while you do have to directly attack another player, the game takes which player to attack out of your hands.
Yeah.
You know, you draw a card and it tells you you're attacking the orange player, and you're like, well, I guess I'm sorry, I'm attacking you now.
You're like, I may have allied it with you on the last three turns, but the cards say I have to attack you, so sorry.
So you have very little opportunity to be deliberately or directly vindictive.
Well, the other thing that Cosmic Encounter does that's cool, and this podcast is turning more into why we love Cosmic Encounter, or why I love Cosmic Encounter anyway, more than what we like about different game styles, but one of the things that Cosmic Encounter does kind of well is the same thing we like. So another competitive style of game that we tend to get into is Coup and the Resistance, or the Resistance Avalon, where they are competitive, but it's like, am I being competitive? It's mostly I'm being competitive by maybe lying to you. So it's not quite as overt as like, I'm attacking you. It's like, I'm going to do this thing. Do you think I actually can? And so Cosmic Encounter has a little bit of that because, you know, maybe you've allied with a player. I've allied with Tom the last three turns, but it comes my turn and it says I have to attack him. I can just be like, oh, you know, sorry, Tom, I didn't really mean to do this. Here, I'll just send one ship at you and you can brush it off like it's no problem. And he'll be like, yes, I'll do that. But then maybe he could be bluffing and he could throw one ship at me, but then play a card with a 30 on it and destroy me. So there's some of that. We don't mind the bluffing so much. I don't mind the bluffing so much. I can't put too much on Tom because we don't have exactly the same brain. It's just pretty close.
True. Yeah, but no, you're right. I think certain breeds of bluffing make sense. Because I'm pretty sure one of the games I've wanted to try but haven't dared to is Game of Thrones. And that is supposed to be an incredible strategy game with a lot of depth to how the different factions interact and whatnot, and a lot of cool stuff you can do. But it encourages a breed of bluffing that I'm pretty sure would end not only our friendship, but also both of our marriages to our actual wives if they were to join in the shenanigans. And because it's more of a direct, I'm screwing you over type of lie, rather than a, this is the role I was dealt to play, and I'm going to play it type of lie.
How does that one work?
Well, like, I mean, there's no roles or anything. It's just you're each a noble house. And so, like, you might say, like, suppose, you know, you and I were adjacent noble houses to our friend Gary's empire, right?
Good old Gary.
Good old Gary. And Gary, you were going to attack Gary. The way it works, as I understand, I've never played it, is that you would say, okay, Tom, I'm going to attack Gary here. Could you support me? And if you support me, I'll win. If you don't support me, I'll probably lose. And I'd say, okay, I will play this, but I play my I'm going to support you card face down, and so you don't know if I'm actually lying or not.
Okay.
And then when we reveal it, it turns out I was not. I supported Gary, actually. And so you were just outnumbered 2-1. So
it's not even, I didn't support you, it's I supported someone else.
Well, it might be just, I didn't support anybody. But sure. It also might be, I actually supported the other guy. Okay. And now you're dead.
That's a game that came up, I followed a Reddit board games thread the other day about games that you would be interested in if it weren't for the IP they were using, like if the theme were different.
Yeah.
And that one came up a lot, and I think that's the case for me. Like, that actually seems pretty interesting. I just have no interest whatsoever in Game of Thrones.
It's got another really cool mechanic to it for, like, for commanders.
Mm-hmm.
So a big part of Game of Thrones are, like, the noblemen who are leading the different houses and whatnot.
Right.
And so, like, if you're playing a given house, you're going to have a deck or a hand of all of your noblemen. Like, if you're playing House Stark, you'll have all of the House Stark guys and all of their, you know, sworn noblemen and whatnot.
You'll have Sean Bean.
You'll have Sean Bean.
And no, he'll die.
Spoilers?
No, he dies in everything.
Oh, fair enough.
Also, wasn't that, like, 3 years ago or something?
Yeah, whatever. It doesn't matter. So, like, in the aforementioned scenario where you are attacking Gary, you would play one of your commanders to that attack. But then you can't play that commander again until you've played all of your other ones.
Okay.
So it kind of, like, in that scenario, it represents the fact that once you send him out, it's going to, since it's medieval times, it's going to take him a while to get back.
Sure.
And there's a lot of things that will delay him, making it back to use again. And you might be forced then later on to give it, because two, not all the commanders are good. Like, some of them are just fantastic, some are mediocre, and some are just actively bad to send out. Like, you might have to send the nobleman who is at fighting wars out to lead your battle because he's the only guy you have left. You've already sent out all your other decent fighters and he's a nobleman. So you don't have the opportunity of saying, no, you just need to not do that. You have to give him some chance to do it.
Gotcha.
But that kind of mechanic of you have this set of actions and you don't get them replenished until you use them all is kind of cool. That's one of the that's one of the things I wanted to see about Game of Thrones as a piece of game design.
Sure.
But I also don't want to spend $60 on it just to see that. Back to Eclipse, I think, you know, you're right about it. Because one of the things about Eclipse that's interesting is that you really strongly dislike the particular breed of player versus player that it brings out. And actually, that's not the part of it that I most enjoy. Because, like, I like kicking Gary in the teeth, and I like...
Who doesn't?
Nobody. Everybody kicks him. And I like...
In the teeth.
You know, making Alfonso feel bad about his choices in life.
And who wouldn't?
Who wouldn't? Right. Exactly. Nobody would not share those feelings with me if they knew who I was talking about. Those are two people we know. But the part that I really like about Eclipse is that you've got good information. It's not perfect as to what's going to happen, you know, over the course of a given turn. You don't have every piece of info, but you've got a lot. And so you can look at that, and you can look at the things that will give you victory points, and you can make a pretty informed decision about what your best course of action is going to be. And I enjoy that kind of puzzle on a given turn, where you're thinking, what is going to net me the most points? What is going to be the most optimal move there? That's interesting to me. It's one of the things I really liked about Terra Mystica, which is even more that way than Eclipse is.
That's horrible.
It doesn't have any real direct player versus player confrontation, actually, so you wouldn't mind that part. But it's got a lot of, okay, given the particular goals for this particular turn and what I've got available at the start and what they've got available at the start, what is my optimal play here? That's a pretty fun puzzle, I found, when I played.
That's actually something I don't particularly care for different reasons than just the competitiveness of it, but... It's why I don't care for chess all that much. There's a lot of looking ahead, you know, 10 moves or whatever.
Sure.
It's just not all that interesting to me. I'm sure there's a way in which I could find that interesting if I didn't have such crippling attention deficit disorder. But, like, there's a point where, like, I just want to play the game. Like, I would enjoy chess, I think, with another person who was restricted to playing the game 1 to 2 moves ahead. And I know that, like... has become is not interesting, but, like, I don't want to be thinking 10 moves ahead, and I appreciate in a love letter where they take a card out, so even if you have a computer brain and you can figure out exactly what cards are on the table and the probability of what every other person has in their hand, there's at least one out, and that at least gives you a little bit of doubt as to what is in anyone's hand.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of randomization, and there's a little bit of putting a person's personality and play style into it rather than like, well, I know that you could use this defense and then this move and mm-hmm. whatever.
So it's a little bit that chess is not solved, but at higher levels you're going to need to know the openings and all of that.
Yeah.
And a little bit just that it's so measured that you can plan that far ahead.
Mm-hmm.
More than a little bit.
It becomes, well, with chess specifically, it becomes almost more about memorization than gaming anymore. But even in other games, like if a love letter didn't leave a card out, you could pretty much be like, okay, I know what's on the table already played. I know how many cards there are in the draw pile. Mm-hmm. And I know that each player other than me has one card in hand. So, you know, statistically, I can figure out what people probably have.
But I mean, you still do that with love letter. There's just one more variable, the card that's set out. That doesn't actually change that math.
It doesn't change. And that's the thing. I don't interact with games on that level. And if I were playing with someone who did explicitly, I would never enjoy myself. Mm-hmm. They would always win, and I would never bother to try to interact with the game on that level to beat them because it would cease to be interesting. Did you ever play a game called Lights Out? It was like a little electronic game.
I think so, yeah.
Back in like the 90s.
I don't remember it well, but I think
it would give you a grid of lights, and I forget if it was, I think it was like 9x9. Mm-hmm. I think it was smaller than that, actually. Maybe it was 5x5. And you had to, every time you press a light, it turns on that light and every light north, east, south, and west of it, unless they're on already, in which case it turns them off.
So it toggles itself and all the lights around it?
Exactly. Well, okay. But not diagonal from it.
Okay,
cardinal directions. There was an algorithm. There was basically a way to figure out how to play this game so that you could beat every level, if not in the optimal number of turns, at least quickly enough. Or like a Rubik's Cube is the same kind of way. Once you learn the math of how it works, there's just like a set type mm-hmm. of number of turns that you do enough times, and then now you've got it based on where you started from or something. It's not interesting anymore. That's just a math problem.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's interesting from a math standpoint, but in my mind, it's not a game anymore. It's just become, can I calculate this thing? And like, if I wanted to calculate a thing, I'd sit down and try to calculate a thing, or like try to write mm-hmm. a proof, or maybe like
a
program.
You're kind of looking for at least a little bit of enough of an injection of chaos on each round or turn or whatever that you're reacting to something new rather than just calculating an iteration from the previous turn.
Yeah, I feel like that's a lot of the benefit of board games that even as good as computer games have gotten, even they can't always add. It's just that random, like you never know how the other player is going to respond.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can try to figure out their personality and what they're thinking, but you can never really know that necessarily.
For example, Alfonso will be as vindictive as humanly possible.
That is absolutely the case. And if there's nothing to be vindictive about, he'll just be mean.
Yeah, he will just be unkind for reasons that are known not even to him. It's true. Could not explain it.
Entirely unclear.
Entirely unclear. Deeply, deeply unclear. So right, we've solved it.
That's it. We figured it out. We know everything there is to know now.
Damn.
So, there are games that are competitive, that are objectively competitive, that I still like. There's Sails of Glory.
Sails of Glory, for those that don't know, and shame on you, is a majestic miniature strategy game where you each control a Napoleonic sailing ship or several of either the British or the French, and you sail it around the board and you blow each other up with cannons, and it's got a great damage tracking system, really interesting mechanics. Does a pretty good job of modeling how sailing ships move around. I mean, it's not perfect.
As best as you can on a board game, and it's really good.
And really the only reason we don't play it more is that I haven't sprung for a crapload of 100-gun frigates at this point, really.
Also, it's a fair amount of setup.
It is a bit of setup, true.
It's not Arkham levels of setup. But it's also not Arkham levels of gameplay, time-wise.
Yeah, but it's not just competitive, but that's the only component of it. Like,
you are shooting at each other with broadsides and muskets.
And somebody eventually loses their boat and is sunk and is no longer around.
Or stupidly misjudges the wind and sails off the edge of the board and dies.
Yeah, that happens too, a lot.
To Tom.
To me.
Yeah. So that game is great. So it's not that I dislike competitive games necessarily. It's just certain styles of play, or certain styles of play that are encouraged by the game rules.
Because mm-hmm. you really can't math Sails of Glory at all.
Yeah, well, probably someone incredibly brilliant could, but at that point, like, you're going to lose pretty much all the games.
Well, I mean, but really, Sails of Glory is so much about positioning, and the movement rules are so... It's hard to eyeball, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe that's just that we don't play it enough. That
well, you could probably math the... Math is a verb now, by the way. Mm-hmm. Oxford English Dictionary editors, if you're listening to this, please add math as a verb and credit me.
Well, they're from England, so it would have to be maths.
Nope. No, that's wrong. But, and they should feel bad. Oxford English Dictionary editors, if you're listening, maths is dumb. It's math.
But there's more than one math. That's what... That's why.
Well, okay, we're going to sidetrack now.
Legit.
I'm going to explain this poorly without using any cited sources because I can't remember where they were because it was too long ago. But I actually read an interesting article about that because it was making me upset, as things do. And I decided why. I'm going to find out etymologically why the British say maths and we say math in the United States. And it turns out maths as. The way they say it as a word did not emerge until I want to say it was the early 20th century.
Really?
Yeah, it's fairly recent. And so there's the argument that, well, we both speak English and you guys left England and so we have it right, that's thrown out. And even the Queen's English kind of argument isn't all that. I mean, okay, there's the Queen right now. So maybe if it's her English, maybe if it was her idea, you could make that excuse. But we don't have that Queen that you have, Great Britain. So take that and smoke it in your pipe. But yeah, it's like from like the
Johannes,
early...
Johannes has feelings about the British.
No, never. It's I'm going to see if I can dig it up here. Because it was etymology of man's. So I found an article. I don't know if it's the one I read originally, but I found it on worddetective.com. That's
Man,
word.
You found that really fast, too.
Word-detective.com. I'm very good at what I do.
Like, remarkably quick.
Yeah. It says that the first instance of maths was in 1847. Oh, no. Math. Actually, as a shorthand for mathematics, first appeared in 1847, but with a period after it. So math, the U.S. way.
But as an abbreviation rather than as a standalone word?
Right. So previous to that, it had all been mathematics. Mathematics, not maths. Take that, British people. The first instance of maths in written language was in 1911. So I was right, early 20th century. And that was in Britain. And so there's really like, it's fairly arbitrary. You can make the argument, as many do, that it's mathematics, not mathematic. Okay. But you don't generally pluralize abbreviations. So that's also a little weird. So anyway, that's my tangent. Math came first. Take that, suckers.
I don't care because it's not a real academic discipline.
What, math?
Yeah.
Okay, or maths.
Or maths, either one.
Wouldn't it be that they are not real academic disciplines, the maths?
I think the proper pluralization is actually they are not real academics discipline.
Tom has a master's in English, so he would know.
It's true, I do. I would know that. So we talked a lot about games that we like, games that we hate, games that got away from us and have left us brokenhearted and weeping and wondering what might have been had we... You know, just said what we should have said to them at that moment when we had the opportunity. And why were we so stubborn and so foolish then as to not speak up and say what was in our hearts just then to the board game when we needed to?
Tom's having sort of a breakdown over there. But actually something we haven't touched on in this this topic is games that we have designed. Of course, which none of you will have.
We design games.
Any reference for having not released any of them? Rather, us. We, not us.
Are you drunk?
We? Yes, I'm on. Well, I'm on gin and tonic number two, but I'm pretty close to the bottom. Yeah. So I don't know that we've designed any outright competitive games, have we? Other than Wiki Sleuth. Which is not a game yet.
Two-headed ogre was going to be.
Oh, two-headed ogre was great.
Two-headed ogre was a great idea that has not, I have not come even close to designing. So the idea with two-headed ogre, and maybe one of you will steal this and make a game that I can buy and play all the time.
Which again is great as long as it's under $35.
two-headed ogre, the idea was that each team of players takes control of an ogre that has a certain number of heads.
Namely, two.
Right. And so the players would need to cooperate in order to drive their ogre around, and they might not properly cooperate somehow, or we weren't sure how to make that happen. So they might flail around when they didn't want to, and they would fight each other. Teams would fight each other
right.
in an arena of ogres. And it would just kind of be this chaotic, ridiculous ogre brawl where ogres are stumbling around, and sometimes they turn when they don't mean to because one person played a right leg movement when they needed a left leg or whatever, and it's just this goofy, chaotic mess.
Yeah. And it was a pretty good idea, we thought. Tom came up with the majority of it, and we tweaked it a little bit in conversation. And then when we finally went to playtest, we didn't even really try to playtest the whole thing. We had questions about how it was going to function. But we thought, at least we will try to do a playtest where we try to move the ogres around and have rudimentary combat abilities. And so we pitted ourselves. This was probably actually our problem. It probably should have been like me and Gary against you and Alfonso instead of me and you against Gary and Alfonso
true.
For the sake of fairness. But whatever the case, we destroyed them. We just annihilated them.
Yeah. Well, but the other problem there was that Alfonso was high out of his mind on pain meds because he just had surgery. He just had surgery, yeah. So he doesn't remember being at my house that day.
And Gary had a lot to drink.
Gary...
Like, a lot.
Yeah.
He christened your toilet with his vomit.
Do we really want to tell that story?
We just did.
And there's really no editing that, is there?
He made a lot of noises. Noises I'm not comfortable having heard. And that is what happened. But whatever the case, we destroyed them handily. And we've really not touched it since.
No, we really haven't. Well, that was a weird day.
It was a weird day.
It was weird and uncomfortable for all of us.
Was that the first attempt at gaming at your house?
That was the first time I think any of you had been to my house since I moved to it.
Yeah.
I like that house.
So we've made, I think that's the only outright competitive game we've attempted to create.
It's certainly the only one we've gotten to the playtesting stage. I'm trying to think if there's any other designs we had that were out and out. F you got mine type games.
Math Wizards was cooperative.
I'm sorry, did you say meth or math?
Either way. Big Man is co-op. Well, no, Big Man is competitive.
But not directly?
Not directly.
You're not forced to poo on each other in order to win.
That's not... Okay, yeah. That's not what how competitive games... Listen, let's keep the poo to a minimum, okay?
Oh, yeah, so we're allowed to talk...
This is a family game.
This is a family podcast. We're allowed to talk about Gary getting all screwed up and puking in my toilet, but we can't talk about poop?
Well, yeah, no, we can't.
That's
how that works.
Is that what that censor guy that came by from the FCC said?
He said, stop doing it right now, or the federal government will sue.
It being the podcast entirely?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Take that, FCC.
Right, we're just dropping the mic and...
Don't drop the mics. They were so expensive.
YOLO hashtag.
The hashtag comes first.
Yeah. Hit us up on the Twitter or in the comments section or by smoke signal.
You could also use email. Probably a level of technology slightly between comments and smoke signals.
We got a comment section at mildlyalarming.com. We have a Twitter at mildlyalarming.
And that's true.
And we also have an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com. That's gmail.com.
Gmail.
And now, a word from our sponsor. The Mildly Alarming Podcast is brought to you by Gribbley's Barbecue. Try our new pork festival. A full pound of shredded bacon and pulled pork laid on a bed of pork chops for just $12.99. Comes with dipping gravy. Add another pint for only $1. Gribbley's, the opposite of a salad.
Welcome back. For this section, we're going to be talking about another game mechanic, sort of a game mechanic. If any of you follow any board game developers, designers, producers, publishers, enthusiasts on Twitter, you may be aware of an event and a hashtag called Board Game Hour, where at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, except this week when Daylight Savings Time threw off all of the poor people from the UK.
Freaking Yanks.
No, we're the Yanks. Oh, oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It was at 3 p.m. this week because of the time difference. At 2 p.m. each Monday, there's an hour of board game discussion where a lot of board game enthusiasts and designers discuss a series of questions about a given game mechanic or just board games in general. And this week it was about rule books. There were a lot of questions. I want to say 13, but that doesn't sound like a number that makes any sense. So it must have been 12. When defined, every 5 minutes there's a new question over the course of Board Game Hour. And I want to say there was a 13th question, but why? Am I that bad at math? Does 13 make any sense?
No, 13 is nonsense if there's one every 5 minutes. Because yeah. 5 times 12 is a dozen.
So we talked about rule books a lot. And it was pretty interesting for me. It was the first time we've had any opportunity to get in to a discussion with other board game designers and people who are really into it. It's put on by the Minister of Board Games at mofbg.co.uk. He puts up the question. Well, I assume he could be she. There's a picture of a dude with like a bowler hat and a monocle and a mustache. And so I you know, it could be a man.
Incidentally, the fact that the UK has a Minister of Board Games and we don't have a Department of Board Gaming in the United States Cabinet is really quite shameful on our part.
You're a gigantic clown. Just it's not even a government address. It's just a guy. He just said that about...
You can't just claim to be the Ministry of Board Gaming if you're not.
We can't be friends anymore.
I'm free.
This guy creates the questions each week, and I'm going to see if I can pull up last week's questions, but I think I missed them. So I'll try to remember them as we talk, if it comes up in conversation. But the Board Game Hour discussion was about rule books this week. It was really interesting. I'm very thankful to all the people who were really cool about my noobishness while I was doing this, while I probably should have been doing other more professional work-related things at the job that I have that pays me. It was pretty good. So rule books are what we're going to talk about today.
Rule books. Well, I mean, I think one of the points I kept seeing over and over again in a variety of forms throughout the responses on Twitter that people were posting was, you know, just maybe like when you finish writing your rule book, read it through a time and make sure it all still makes sense at
this
point.
It's true. There was a shocking number of people who were... if not surprised as though they'd never done it before, surprised that other people read through and edit and playtest their rule books.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something, again, us, we've only really been into board games for about 5 years. We've only been into designing for a little over 2, right?
Roughly.
And
has it been that long?
Yeah, it has. Jeez. It has. And like one of the first things we did was one of the first games we attempted, and one that we had the good sense to give up on that may come back in another iteration later, was something that we initially called, I think it was called Rift, which we jokingly but not inaccurately referred to as Math Wizards because it involved a lot of counting and addition of dice and dividing into various things for spells. And one of the first things we did with it when we got to what we thought was playable, because as we developed these rules, and we'll get to this maybe a little later, but our game design process usually ends up creating a rule book as the first thing that exists.
It's very, very early on.
Like, a game idea is like, here's an idea. And if we don't like bounce ideas off of one another enough to create a cohesive game while we're conversing, one of us will usually will either give up on the idea or want for the time being, or one of us will sit down and say, all right, I'm going to make this game work. And at the end of that process, we'll end up with a very rudimentary bullet point based rule book. That's basically like, here are the components you need. Here's the point of the game, and here's how a turn looks. and we start from there. And so when we first tried Math Wizards, when we got it to a point we thought was playable, the sort of final point for us for the game when we finally gave up on it and decided not to go back to it for a while was when we sat somewhere else in the building and let a group of four other people who had never seen it before try to decipher our rule book and see if they could figure out how to play this game on their own.
They could not.
They couldn't. It was a disaster. We set up my phone with the camera running to see if we could watch later and figure out where they went wrong and if there was anything we could try to fix it or ways they misinterpreted the rules. Sometimes the way that people misinterpret the rules is actually way better than what you intended.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought maybe we could end up with something better than we did. Instead, we just ended up with, like, we can't do anything with this game. We should give up for a while and move on to something else.
Oh, you know, some of the things that caused them trouble in that playtest are things that some of the suggestions on Board Game Hour kind of addressed, is that our rules documents that we put together at this point tend to be pretty much strict rules documents. There's not a lot of examples. There's no formatting beyond bullet points, really. You know, there's no breakout boxes or side columns or anything. And a lot of the points they made were like, be sure to have things that clarify easily misinterpreted points.
Mm-hmm.
Be sure to have examples. And a lot of people said they liked things like anatomy of a turn sections. And
actually,
just...
I said that. That was me.
Oh, I'm looking right at that. Was you who's posted that.
I'm so clever.
I know. You're just a smart young man. I'm sorry, what were we talking about?
I have no idea.
But, you know, having those kind of examples and breakouts and things to illustrate and make concrete the more abstract elements of your rule sets are very useful, especially for people that, unlike you, the game designer, have not been deeply immersed in the world of the game for a long, long time
mm-hmm.
at that point. So that was something that I liked to see, I was glad to see reflected there, because it's something I'd suspected we needed to be doing. And we needed to do further on down the line for a while, but hadn't really, you know, hit with any kind of emphasis yet.
So there's something I'd like to point out to make me feel a little bit less stupid. There was, in fact, a question marked question 13. It just said, time's up, folks. Hope you enjoyed this week's Board Game Hour.
Ah.
So it's not really a question so much as a statement, but there was a number 13. So I'm not completely stupid.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, you know, a lot of the other points. Another good one. Where'd it go? Right. Another really good point that somebody made on the Twitter user Daniel Solis. So if you're out there, I'm giving you internet fist bumpings here. He said, look at how players intuitively arrange their play space. Document it and include it in diagrams for your rules. And I thought that was really good because you see it happen sometimes where the diagram in the rule book of how players should arrange their cards or their board pieces or whatever in front of them doesn't match at all what makes sense for reality.
Mm-hmm.
That actually happens out in the when people are actually playing the game. So I think just sort of looking at how people intuitively put together their components, unless there's a specific reason they have to be in a particular way, and then just using that as your example, is a good way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. A shout out to Daniel Solis, too, because at the beginning, because of the unexpected time change for some of us, there was a few, maybe half an hour or so, of people just hanging out in there's a nerf.com, N-U-R-P-H, nerf. Sort of Twitter chat room for Board Game Hour that went on for a while before the Board Game Hour actually began. And he gave us a pretty good primer on how to use grids to help lay out a rule book in a way that makes sense. And it was sort of an unexpected out of the blue primer on graphic design for rule books. And we got to a question later on in actual Board Game Hour once it started about how to lay out your book and do you like two or three columns better. And pretty much everyone's answer was, well, I would have said X before, but now that I've heard Daniel Solis' little primer on how to use grids in book layout, I'm going to say grids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's at Daniel, D-A-N-I-E-L, Solis, S-O-L-I-S. He's pretty great, and thanks for that. That was really super helpful.
Mm-hmm. It's good stuff. It's a capital fellow, my new best friend.
Who you've never met or even heard of until right this minute.
I heard
you
of him.
Fickle.
the other day when you did this and you tweeted
on Twitter. I'm not your best friend anymore.
No, you're still my best friend.
Thanks, babe.
Yeah, I know, right? All right. Do we have anything else to say about rule books?
Probably, but it's getting about time to wrap things up. So if you listeners have input on games rule books that you think are great or think are terrible, things that you wish rule books would have more frequently or would leave out because they're a waste of space, let us know.
And we will be taking a bet right now on exactly how many times you think Arkham Horror's rulebook will come up as an example of terrible rulebooks.
I actually embarrassingly put in there that I like the Arkham Horror rulebooks. They're terrible as far as being able to follow them, but they look super nice. Well, and they did a pretty good job of using the index at the back and then just piles and piles and piles of errata to fix the rules that they missed.
Well, you know, if you think of them not as rule books, but as part of the experience, they do feel like reading through a book of eldritch horrors that slowly scrambles your mind and drives you into ethereal, nightmarish madness.
It's true. There's a sort of insanity forced upon you as you try to find where a given thing is in this.
Cthulhu Fatagan.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have any input, hit us up in the comments section on mildlyalarming.com, on Twitter at mildlyalarming, or by email if you have just a whole lot to say at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
And if you've got ideas for solving world hunger, maybe call somebody else. We're not the guys for that. But you should tell somebody if you've got a good idea for that. It's important.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Major funding for the Mildly Alarming podcast has been provided by the National Endowment for Creative Spoonerism. Additional funding has been provided by the Meardsley Q Beat Puff Foundation, the Borporation for Krublik Podcasting, and by annual financial support from viewers like you.